Hi, you're with Truth News Radio on the 7th of January, 2017. Great to have you aboard. Today I want to begin the show by talking a little about Bitcoin. It's been in the news lately. There's been some tremendous volatility with Bitcoin over the past couple of months. And recently Bitcoin has gone through a kind of a plunge in value, which appears to have been triggered by a statement issued by China's central bank. Now, the research I've done on Bitcoin indicates that the appreciation in value of Bitcoin over the past 6 months has been largely due to Chinese investors, and it's Chinese investors moving away from other safe havens like gold and putting them more into Bitcoin. But the Chinese central bank seems to be trying to change things. They're trying to re-engineer things. And they issued a statement just a few days ago stating that Bitcoin is not a currency and should not be viewed as such. Those who invest in Bitcoin should accordingly be aware of the risks it poses and protect their investment. Now, as a result of this announcement, the value of Bitcoin plummeted, and it was well over $1,000. I think it went up to about $1,100, and it's now plunged, as of today, plunged back down to about $830, still well above the level that it was at 6 months ago. And there's still an overall trend that shows that Bitcoin is very, very strong. But I wanted to get into today to talking a little bit about Bitcoin and even get a little bit deeper into what, in the context of these new types of currencies, what our money really is, because I think it's getting very confused, and I think a lot of people are going to be let down due to their belief in things that aren't actually substantial. I mean, look, Bitcoin's really interesting and the technology is really important, the technology behind it. But what concerns me about it is that, I mean, even less than the fiat currency of a nation state, Bitcoin's value is only determined by the fact that people want to buy it. Now, when a nation state issues currency, that currency can be backed by the productivity of a country, and governments with the central bank can underwrite the value of a currency to a certain extent. I mean, it does break down in certain situations, and there's plenty of historical examples of that when you get hyperinflation, such as we're now seeing in Venezuela. But when you have a nation state with a central bank backing a currency, it has more chance of being stable over the long term than something that is just purely market-driven, which has no real intrinsic value. It doesn't represent any intrinsic value on its own, unlike, say, gold, which, as a precious metal, it has an intrinsic value. And if we compare the value of gold over the past year with the value of Bitcoin, we see gold has been much more stable. But another interesting thing to note is that the price of gold has actually gone down. It's actually devalued a little, and it's certainly devalued considerably since the massive peaks that we saw in 2011-2012. But while gold has been devaluing, Bitcoin has been going up and up and up. And to me, and I'm certainly not an expert, I'm just merely presenting to you the research I've done, but to me, It looks to me as if there could be something slightly dodgy going on with Bitcoin, and that really anything's possible. I mean, we could see it continue to appreciate. We could see it go to much higher values. I've got an article here from RT, which states that under Trump, Bitcoin could triple in value, according to Saxo Bank. So it could triple in value, but perhaps it could also collapse in value. I mean, we really don't know. There are so many unknowns in this whole equation that it seems to me to put all one's eggs into a basket like Bitcoin would be an extremely risky venture. Of course, many people have benefited and profited from Bitcoin over the past few years, but it's quite likely that some unknown event in the future will just radically change the value of Bitcoin. But what's really interesting is that it's not just about the value of Bitcoin, it's about the value of the technology on which Bitcoin is based. And I've got an article here from Wired magazine. The title of the article is "Bitcoin Will Never Be a Currency, It's Something Way Weirder." The value of Bitcoin surged past 1,000. This is an article just from a couple of days ago, indeed, the 6th of January, just yesterday. The value of Bitcoin surged past $1,000 this week, the first time it has reached such heights since late 2013. But don't let that big number fool you. This strange and controversial technology is no closer to becoming a mainstream currency. Even Olaf Carlson Wee, the first employee at Coinbase, the country's most important Bitcoin company, will tell you that. Bitcoin will never be a substitute for the dollar. It was a big mistake that any of this was ever compared to currency, Carlson Wee says. This seemingly pessimistic sentiment is what you hear more and more often, not only from people on the fringes on the Bitcoin community, but also those at the heart of it. Bitcoin is not something the average person will ever use to buy and sell stuff, they say, particularly in the US and other Western countries. The world just doesn't need a dedicated digital currency. It's already pretty easy to pay for stuff with dollars thanks to debit cards and the internet and any number of smartphone services. And even if the need was there, too many legal, regulatory, and cultural hurdles stand in Bitcoin's path to mainstream adoption. Right now, Bitcoin is useful mainly as digital gold, as an investment. Precious metal-style speculation is why Bitcoin's value is on the rise. The price is going up because people think the price will keep going up, particularly people in China. Bitcoin is also a useful way of moving money across international borders, and that will likely be its main application over the next several years. But for Carlson Wee, Bitcoin is most valuable as something else entirely. Not as a new currency, not as a new gold, not as a new Western Union, but as something that enables financial phenomena that have never existed before. What Carlson Wee calls programmatic finance. Through the idea of a blockchain, Carlson Wee believes, it will power businesses that essentially own and run themselves, a role more important than any one currency. Now, the article goes on to explain some of this detail, and it's quite technical, and the main thrust of this is to understand that the blockchain technology on which Bitcoin is based enables the creation of a new way of creating value. value obviously is relative and is only determined in relation to some kind of system that it's based within. But the technology on which Bitcoin is based is going to increasingly be used in all kinds of other ways, not just as a tradable commodity, but as a way of actually putting value into a company. I don't fully understand it, but it's just a very interesting concept, and I'll certainly put the links up there on Truth News for you to have a look at. I think one thing to be aware of with the way the world has changed over the past just couple of decades, with economies so interlinked, with so many people now travelling and working in different environments, there is a huge economy which is not actually within the sphere of the normal economies of nation states. There is a huge contingent of people who are described as digital nomads, and this has been made possible by the internet and by the businesses and the technologies that exist on the internet. People are able to run businesses from remote parts of the world. They're able to travel, and their entire business and their entire method of attaining money is through an online system which is not linked to any country. Now, this creates interesting situations. I mean, nation states, of course, are always keen to tax people, and the people who are able to operate outside of the tax network are eluding the power of the government and the central banks. And this is probably the main reason behind China's attempt to quash Bitcoin, and this has happened before, and it'll probably keep happening. My thoughts on it are that we really need to actually think about what value really does represent. I mean, to me, value is about something concrete. It's about something that you actually do physically, something that you produce that has value for other people. And to that extent, even precious metals, even gold, the value of that is based on its rarity. Of course, it's a useful resource and it is used in industry, but it's based on rarity, and the value of Bitcoin is also based on its rarity, which has been deliberately created. We're going to break. You're at Truth News Radio Australia. It's a great pleasure to be with you today. We'll be right back. Stay with us. Welcome back, you're with Truth News Radio. And I'm talking about Bitcoin today, and I want to actually follow this up by playing a bit of an introductory video on it, because I know a lot of people don't fully understand it, and I'm certainly in that category as well. I've not had time to really fully educate myself in many things, of which Bitcoin is one. But I think it's important to try and understand better what it is. If you're thinking about perhaps putting some money into it, it's kind of important to understand what the system and the core dynamics of it are. So I've got a little introductory video on it here, which I've plucked out of YouTube, and I'll play that and perhaps comment on it as we go forward. A video entitled here, How Bitcoin Works Under the Hood. Here we go.
The goal of this video is to explain how Bitcoin works under the hood, to give a clearer idea of what it really means to own, send, or mine Bitcoins. First, a brief high-level overview of what Bitcoin is. At its core, Bitcoin is just a digital file that lists accounts and money like a ledger. A copy of this file is maintained on every computer in the Bitcoin network. These numbers don't represent anything in the physical world. They only have value because people are willing to trade real goods and services for a higher number next to their account and believe others will do the same. The numbers only have value because we believe they have value, just like any other fiat currency. To send money, you broadcast to the network that the amount on your account should go down and the amount on a receiver's account up. Nodes or computers in the Bitcoin network apply that transaction to their copy of the ledger and then pass on the transaction to other nodes. This, with some math-based security, is really all there is, a system that lets a group of computers maintain a ledger. While this may sound similar to the way a bank maintains a ledger, the fact that the ledger is maintained by a group rather than a single entity introduces a number of important differences. For one, unlike a bank where you only know about your own transactions, in Bitcoin, everyone knows about everyone else's transactions. Also, while you can trust your bank, or you can at least sue it if something goes wrong, in Bitcoin, you're dealing with anonymous strangers, so you shouldn't trust anyone. The Bitcoin system is amazingly designed so that no trust is needed. Special mathematical functions protect every aspect of the system. The rest of this video will explain in detail how Bitcoin allows such a group of strangers to manage each other's financial transactions. At a basic level, for Alice to send money to Bob, she simply broadcasts a message with the accounts and the amount. Send 5 bitcoins from Alice to Bob. Every node that receives it will update their copy of the ledger and then pass along the transaction message. But how can nodes be sure that the request is authentic, that only the rightful owner has sent the message? Bitcoin rules require a kind of password to unlock and spend funds, and this password is what's called a digital signature. Like a real handwritten signature, it proves the authenticity of a message, but it does so through a mathematical algorithm that prevents copying or forgery in the digital realm. Unlike a simple static password, a completely different digital signature is required for every transaction. Keep in mind that in Bitcoin, you're dealing with complete strangers, so you never want to reveal a password that could be copied and reused by someone else. A digital signature works by utilizing 2 different but connected keys, a private key to create a signature and a public key that others can use to check it. You can think of the private key as the true password and the signature as an intermediary that proves you have the password without requiring you to reveal it. Public keys are actually the send-to addresses in Bitcoin, so when you send someone money, you're really sending it to their public key. To spend money, you must prove that you're the true owner of a public key address where money was sent, and you do that by generating a digital signature from a transaction message and your private key. Other nodes in the network can use that signature in a different function to verify that it corresponds with your public key. Through the math behind the digital signature, they are able to verify that the sender owned a private key without actually seeing the private key. Importantly, because the signature depends on the message, it will be different for every transaction and therefore can't be reused by someone for a different transaction. This dependence on the message also means that no one can modify the message while passing it along the network, as any changes to the message would invalidate the signature. The math behind this is fairly complex, and while I won't try to explain it fully now, here are some topics you can Google to get started. Elliptic curve digital signature algorithm and mathematical trapdoor. More at the end of the video. So far, we know that digital signatures are used to ensure a transaction is authorized, but I've oversimplified how nodes in the network keep track of account balances. In fact, no records of account balances are kept at all. If you don't keep track of how much money any given person has, how do you know if they have enough to send to someone else? Instead of balances, ownership of funds is verified through links to previous transactions. Here's how this works. To send 5 bitcoins to Bob, Alice must reference other transactions where she received 5 or more bitcoins. These reference transactions are called inputs. Other nodes verifying this transaction will check those inputs to make sure Alice was in fact the recipient, and also that the inputs add up to 5 or more bitcoins. Let's look at a real transaction to see this in practice. This transaction references 6 inputs for a total of 139.6 bitcoins. In the output section, notice that there are 2 lines. The first one of these is actually going back to the sender as change for the transaction. A simplifying rule states that each input must be used up completely in a transaction. So if you're trying to send an amount that doesn't exactly match one of your inputs, you need to send any remaining amount back to yourself. Through these reference input linkages, ownership of bitcoins is passed along in a kind of chain, where the validity of each transaction is dependent on previous transactions. But how can you trust those previous transactions? You can't, and you should check their inputs too. In fact, when you first install Bitcoin wallet software, it downloads every transaction ever made and checks each one's validity all the way back to the very first transaction. Remember, you're dealing with complete strangers, so it's important to verify every transaction for yourself. This process can take over 24 hours, but it only needs to be done once. Once a transaction has been used once, it is considered spent and cannot be used again. Otherwise, someone could double spend an input by referencing it in multiple transactions. When verifying a transaction, in addition to the other checks, nodes also make sure the inputs haven't already been spent. To be explicit, for each input, nodes check every other transaction ever made to make sure that input hasn't already been used before. While this may seem time-consuming, as there are now over 20 million transactions, it's made fast with an index of unspent transactions. So, instead of a ledger of balances, Bitcoin nodes keep track of a giant list of transactions. Owning Bitcoins means that there are transactions in this list that point to your name and haven't been spent, or in other words, used as inputs in other transactions. One interesting consequence of this ownership structure is that figuring out your own balance requires iterating through every transaction ever made and adding up all your unspent inputs. Another interesting note about transactions is that the system can support more complex ones than simply sending funds to one person. You may have noticed a cryptic-looking line of text in the output shown previously. It turns out that outputs are more like puzzles to be solved rather than simple to addresses. Rather than emailing, sending money in Bitcoin is more like putting money in a public locker and attaching a math puzzle that must be solved to open it. The puzzle is defined using a special scripting language, and while it's typically designed so that only a single owner of a public key can solve it, more complex conditions are possible. For instance, 2 out of 3 signatures could be required for an escrow-based transaction. Another example is the very first Bitcoin transaction ever made, which was a puzzle that anyone could solve. While most Bitcoin software hides the scripting layer for you, you're free to write your own software and claim conditions, although this can be risky. Over 2,600 Bitcoins were lost in one batch of transactions due to a malformed address. This highlights an important part of Bitcoin. As there is no bank or credit card company you can appeal to, any user error mistakes can result in permanent loss of Bitcoins, and not just from your own account, but from the Bitcoin economy overall. If you lose your private key, any funds associated with the corresponding public key will be gone forever. Because people will likely lose private keys due to hard drive crashes and insufficient backups, this means the Bitcoin currency will eventually be a deflationary one. Before explaining the final piece that secures Bitcoin, mining, I want to highlight a few points about anonymity in Bitcoin. If you access Bitcoin through a Tor network that hides your IP address, you can use Bitcoin without ever revealing anything more than your public key. And to avoid someone linking your transactions together, remember they're all publicly stored on every computer, you can generate a new public key for every incoming transaction. It is possible, however, to inadvertently link public keys together. In the transactions shown earlier, 6 input transactions were used as sources, and despite the fact that all those inputs were sent to different addresses, they all became linked in that transaction. The sender proved that he owned all of those addresses by supplying the digital signature to unlock each one. Researchers have, in fact, used these links to study Bitcoin user behavior. You might think that generating a public key receiving address could potentially create a link to your true identity, but even this step is anonymous, and amazingly can be done with no connection to the network. You simply click a button in your wallet software, and it randomly generates a new private and public key. Because there are so many different possible addresses, there's no reason to even check if someone else already has that key.
Okay, we'll have to leave it there. I hope that was of some use to you. Obviously, it's actually quite a complex topic, and it may take more study to fully understand it. And I think we need to understand it if we're going to actually put our fiat currency into something like Bitcoin. We're just going to break. We'll be right back after this short break. Stay with us. Welcome back, you're at Truth News Radio. I want to shift now to another topic. the issue of gender, and this is something that we've looked at on the show from a number of angles. Part of the whole debate over political correctness, cultural Marxism, the way in which we are being kind of socially engineered into developing a completely different concept of gender, and even down to the extent of like what a person is. The concepts of man and woman being eroded in a number of different ways. And it's a little bit dizzying even just trying to get grasp what is actually going on here. Because we've got, on the one hand, we've got the issue of homosexuality, which goes back a long time, and it's, you know, it's well understood, and it's probably the least controversial, because a lot of people have been known to be homosexual going back hundreds of years, going back even thousands of years. It's a known activity that some people engage in homosexual acts, right? But over the last generation or so, we've moved into a redefinition of gender, which partly derives out of this whole history of gender studies and gender theory in the post-World War II era, which starts to blur the distinction between male and female, or legitimizes the concept of gender being a social construct rather than any kind of actual physical, biological, genetic reality. And in many ways, this actually completely contradicts the science itself. And there's a very interesting documentary I saw on this, was made in Norway several years ago, which actually went into the science of gender and then counterposed that against the dogma or the ideology of gender, which is widely followed by people in academic professions like the social sciences and psychology. And it's a very interesting documentary, and I'll actually provide a link to it, because it actually highlights that that the accepted knowledge about gender now that's we find repeated in the mainstream media, that is the grist in the mill of a lot of stuff that goes on in university in the area of social sciences, is actually completely at odds with science. And I mean, to give you like a simple example, obviously men and women are different, right? They do have different genitalia, right? And they have different hormone levels, and therefore they have different capabilities. Now, those who follow the strict ideological belief that gender is a social construct have difficulty with this. They have difficulty actually acknowledging it, and they try to limit the difference as they perceive it. They try to limit the framework of knowledge that they follow. They try to say, well, yes, men and women are different, but only in these areas. You know, yes, they have different genitals. Yes, they have different hormone levels. But hormone levels can be adjusted. So, you know, women can take hormones to make them more like men. Men can take hormones to make them more like women. And this then reasserts their view that gender is a totally fluid construct. And now, even if we were to accept that, That is still not enough. They actually, it appears there is some kind of force in our society that is actually wanting to go even one step further than that, and to basically say that women are men are women, and we have to eliminate the distinction. I just want to play to you a video here that illustrates this. I mean, it's sort of mind-boggling, and it's hard to believe that someone would come up with these ideas. But this video, a girl fighting for her inclusion in Boy Scouts of America, is an example of that. So here we go. I'm just going to switch to the Facebook video page now, and we'll play some of that for you.
It's definitely discriminatory against girls because we have the same ability to earn the rank, but we don't have the access to get that rank.
I learned that equality isn't really an easy thing to attain.
The Eagle rank is the highest award in the Boy Scouts, and I can't achieve it just because I'm a girl. I think that girls should have the opportunity to join either program and earn whatever opportunities they want. The Boy Scouts of America is a great organization, and it would only get better with allowing half of the population, which are girls, into their program, and increasing the diversity within scouting will just make the program better.
Okay. So let's just analyze what we just saw there. This is about a movement, with the face of which is this young girl you just saw, which is trying to defund Boy Scouts of America because it wants Girl Scouts to be able to be Boy Scouts. Even though girls have organizations that they can join, Girl Guides, for example, is a female-only organization that girls can join. But what they want is they don't want men to have an organization which is just for boys. They don't want there to be any kind of exclusively male organization. Now, my analysis of this is actually that what they're trying to do is they're trying to eliminate men. They're basically trying to eliminate men completely. And one has to wonder what's going on there. And when you combine that with gender theory and transgender and the concept that people are non-binary, that they're neither male nor female, we end up with this future that it certainly doesn't correspond to anything in the culture of humanity going back for thousands of years. I mean, is that a future that you want? Now, already we've seen in the Olympic Games that transgender people can compete, and that was a new ruling that was brought in just in 2016. And what we've seen in the Olympic Games is that competitors can change gender and then take hormone therapy. And as long as they're taking hormone therapy to adjust their hormone levels, they are now regarded as competitors in the gender of their choice. Anyway, it's a complex subject. It's a weird topic. Going to break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
What happens in terms of creating wars is a mind manipulation technique called problem reaction solution. And it works like this. And it works like this. First of all, you create the problem, but you get someone else to be blamed for it. You then report that problem through the media in the way you want it reported. You get the public to react to your problem by saying something must be done, this can't go on, what are they going to do about it?
Hi, welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio Australia. Now, I've got one more important news topic to actually cover today, but I just want to finish off on this issue of the paradox of gender and the agenda of those that are pushing for this. My theory about it, my way of understanding it, which kind of just, it gives me a model that I can finally say, yes, I know what's going on here, is that what they're trying to do, and when I say they, I do mean some kind of elite. I mean the coordinated efforts of certain individuals that operate within the sphere of government and academia and within the oligarchies that control the Western world, is that they are trying to move the world towards a new concept of what the human being is, a type of transhumanist world model, and that this world will be one in which the state is kind of like the ultimate religion that people follow. It will be a secular state that is wherein people will be stripped from their organic connection to each other, to their families, so that the power and the control resides within the state. And when you start to understand that this is an agenda and that there are people who are working towards this agenda, you start to understand other phenomena as well, which may seem totally unrelated. And the next story I want to talk about is one such case. It's the cashless welfare debit card that is has been trialled in one town in Australia already. Of course, it was introduced originally for the during the intervention in the Northern Territory, and it was also trialled in some suburbs of Sydney, I believe, and it was trialled in the town of Ceduna. And most recently, the Turnbull government has proposed bringing the cashless debit card in for teenagers who are on the dole to help them manage their finances and to prevent them from spending their money on bad things like alcohol. Now, you look at it from one angle, and it seems reasonable to for the government and for the taxpayers to want to protect their investment, because they're paying taxes, which is a type of investment, and they don't want you, as the Social Security recipient, being able to squander that. But the solution that's proposed puts more power into the state than ever before, and it's the state interlocking with financial institutions to basically be able to firstly monitor everything you do, like every payment you make will be tracked and traced, and then to be able to restrict what you are and are not able to buy. Now, there was some discussion of this on talk shows in Australia just last week, but I want to play to you a video clip about the actual introduction of the trial that was brought in in the town of Ceduna. And this is actually from over a year ago, but it goes into some of the details of this program. Now, this is something that they are very, very intent on rolling out. And typically, when the government has a plan for the future that it wants to roll out that may be controversial, they tend to try it out on minority groups and also on groups that, because they're marginalised, we aren't going to rush to their defence. So initially it was with the people in the intervention, and these were people who already, you know, we knew they had trouble managing their finances, there were terrible problems with alcohol, there was child abuse going on. So, you know, nobody's going to object too much about the government coming in with this nanny state solution saying, look, we're going to help you manage your finances. They did it in, I think, Macquarie Fields in Sydney, which is a suburb, an area of Sydney that has a lot of people who are struggling, people who are not socially well adapted, people who are long-term unemployed. And again, there's a lot of problems with alcohol, there's a lot of problems with violence. And so they can introduce it. And of course, the next stage is bringing it in with teenagers. And again, it's to help. It's kind. But anyway, let's just play some of this clip here from the video piece that was done about a year and a half ago in relation to the introduction of the cashless welfare card in Ceduna. And I'll just get that up on the screen for you. Here we go.
First up, a controversial new welfare card is due to be trialled in Australia by the end of the year. It'll act as a debit card that cannot be used to buy alcohol or to gamble. The federal government sees the cashless welfare card as a way of combating domestic violence and the growing problem of the drug ice in the community. But isn't it taking away the basic rights of people at the extreme end of disadvantage still?
I'm just worried that it attaches a stigma to using it. Like, if because, like, you...
Hang on, using the card or using ice?
No, using the card, using the card. Because it's easy to sit, like, in your lounge room or on the panel and say, yeah, of course, people aren't allowed to, you know, they shouldn't be buying drugs and alcohol with it. But then that's a small minority, and then the people that are, you know, just struggling, try to make ends meet with the card, they might have a stigma, like... Like, I read in one of the papers, they listed it as cashless card for West Australian addicts. Mm. So that's then anyone, you know, like single parents or whatever.
You're branded an addict.
Yeah.
Automatically.
Yeah, and I think it's hard.
It's insulting to the rest of the community on welfare who, you know, are struggling to kind of, you know, just keep their head above water.
This isn't something that would go to all welfare recipients, far, far from it. This is something that would only be rolled out in areas as a trial in places where the people who are suffering real problems are not in the minority, where there is actually endemic problems with alcohol and drug abuse. We're talking about really disadvantaged areas in different parts across the nation. We're not talking about rolling it out nationally to everyone.
But you can see that happening, though. I mean, look at the food stamp situation in the United States. And is this the sort of card that will only be able to be used at big corporations like Woolies and Coles and those sorts of places?
Does it damage smaller business?
I think it's got a lot to do with remote communities. So I'm speaking of where Aborigines live, and the idea might be to try, I think, is to try and reduce domestic violence, where 1 in 10 Aboriginal women are victims of domestic violence. Because if you can't buy booze, which is often the reason why domestic violence breaks out, then that might reduce the risk.
Unfortunately, though, if you're an addict and you don't have cash in your pocket, you are going to find a way of getting drugs and getting alcohol. You might not have the means yourself, but if you're addicted to a substance, you are going to find it, and it's going to make things even more chaotic.
If you're an alcoholic, you don't go, oh, well, I can't buy booze.
Well, I'll give it up then. You've got to choose to give it up. You can't be told by the government, well, you've got to give it up because we think there's a problem here.
Yeah, look, I think that is a concern, that it could just, you know, lead to people, you know, committing acts of crime to try and get it anyway. Having said that, though, if you do make it harder for people to access the thing that is the problem for them, that may crack down the problem. We don't know. We know there's a similar scheme that about 20,000 people in various states and various places have already. This does seem to be, you know, working in those extreme cases where you are case managed into it. If you have had a drinking problem or a gambling problem, you do get your welfare quarantined from that.
OK, Okay, I'm just going to actually play to you the other clip now from Facebook, which was the very, very short clip here from one of the morning shows. And that actually addresses the new plan, which is to bring this on for teenagers. And of course, the argument about putting teenagers on this, it completely shows the lie of everything Ita Buttrose just said there in the interview, that about it's only about helping people where there's been a situation of violence or a situation where there's domestic issues, etc., etc. The government wants to blithely roll this out for all teenagers. It doesn't matter whether you're a good teenager or a bad teenager. So you can really see the workings of the deceptive nature of what is going on with this type of legislation. So I'll just now quickly play.
In some respects, isn't it our money? Because we're the taxpayers that are actually footing the bill for this. And as such, shouldn't we then have a bit of a vested interest and say, well, that's our money, stop wasting it on grog?
Yeah, but shouldn't people be able to decide finance? Well, shouldn't people learn financial management, as Alex says? Like, he's deciding that people should spend their money on X, Y, Z. Is that going to teach them long-term financial skills?
And I guess too, if they're deserving of that welfare because of circumstances, then that is their money to use. And remembering that there are parents out there who don't manage the kids very well at all, so maybe there's a bit of protection on the teenager's part as well. So lots of issues. It's quite an interesting one.
So that was the topic just a few days ago on morning television. So this is what's coming, folks. This is what the social engineers of the nanny state are bringing in. And the type of society that's being brought in is one where, at the same time as this is going on, male values, masculinity, is being treated as something problematic, something to be eliminated. You know, I'm going to get into more of these topics again soon. I do hope you enjoyed the show today, and I will be back next week with more of the same. See you then.